Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 Podcasting Network.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been?
Okay, so continue now talking about synapses and our transmitters. We'll finish that stuff. We'll talk about dependence and addiction. So that's the plan. I'm going to make sure I'm in the right place here to click. There we go. There's a lot of variation in synapses. These are sort of, you might want to call these generic synapses. They don't all look the same, but they're nice diagrams.
What have I done here? Oh, I just moved it. That's the problem.
Some synapses are inhibitory, some are excitatory. Inhibitory ones, instead of letting in sodium, which is a positive ion, I talked about this the other day, positive gets in, right, and it changes the charge across the membrane from being negative to being a little less negative. To make something negative, to make something less likely to fire, you're going to make the charge more negative, so it actually lets in negative ions, typically chlorine. And the big one we'll talk about there is GABA, which I'll talk about in a second, a neurotransmitter. And it is the most common inhibitory neurotransmitter, and it lets in chlorine instead of sodium. Now, people ask, is excitatory versus inhibitory nature of synapses somewhat due to the shape? I don't say due to the shape is probably not the right way to put it. It's more like it may even go the other way around. But inhibitory ones seem to be, they're GABA synapses, have a lot less postsynaptic thickening. So it's something special about GABA synapses. I'm not saying I probably shouldn't say it's due to it. I should say that it's a property of it. It's probably a better way to put it. Glutamate synapses. Glutamate is the most common excitatory neurotransmitter. Indeed, it's the most common neurotransmitter in your nervous system. They have more vesicles and more thickening. Vesicles are just what hold the neurotransmitter molecules before they're released. Glutamate, again, most common neurotransmitter in your brain, always excitatory, which should probably give you an idea that the idea that monosodium glutamate is bad for you is a very strange notion.
As an aside,
it just seems odd that people say they have allergic reactions to the most common neurotransmitter in their brain. Because monosodium glutamate is a simple salt of sodium and glutamate. And if that's the case, you'd be allergic to your brain. It seems unlikely to me. By the way, there is a lethal dose of monosodium glutamate. It's higher than the least lethal dose of sodium chloride, table salt. So don't be afraid of monosodium glutamate. It tastes delicious. I have a bag of it at home. And it's great. I put it in food for cooking. It's a good thing. We even have a taste bud for glutamate. Just thought I'd tell you. I remember once Dwayne Keogh was over for dinner, and during his job interview, because I knew Dwayne already, so the night he got in, he came over to our place, and we were cooking. He said, "Oh, I'll put the. Oh, I found the salt to put on these tomatoes for the salad. It's not salt. That's not table salt. That's MSG." He said, "What's it taste like?" And he tasted it and he said, "It's amazing." You can get it at Bulk Farm. All right. There are 7 types of synapses. We will really concern ourselves with the one important type, which is what's called an axodendritic synapse. Axon to dendrite. There are a whole bunch of others. 6 others. You guys all pretty much all have taken Brain and Behavior. Well, you can worry about that in that class. The one you learned about in Intro Psych, which was axon to dendrite, that's the only one we're going to really concern ourselves with. It's called an axodendritic. But there are like dendrodendritic, that's dendrite to dendrite, axoaxonic, axoextracellular, axosomatic, axosynaptic, and axosecretory. I usually forget axosecretory. The important thing is axon dendrite, most common one, axon to dendrite. And that's all we really care about in this class. Now, when a neuron fires, when it gets an action potential and it fires, it releases neurotransmitter. There are 7 stages in neurotransmission. There's synthesis. A lot of these neurotransmitters are made they're just proteins, right? So they're just coded, the molecules. Not always. Some come in food. Like I said, when you're eating monosodium glutamate, the glutamate's broken down, and you end up just ingesting your own transmitter. On the other hand, if I just gave you dopamine to eat, it would have no effect on you because it can't pass through the blood-brain barrier. So your body makes its own dopamine. It does that usually a lot of times using precursors to dopamine, things that are almost dopamine. So there might be synthesis, there might not be. It might just be we get it directly from food. The neurotransmitters are stored. They're stored in vesicles. Okay? It's not like a just-in-time delivery system where they're made and then released. That would make... Neurotransmission is slow enough on its own. It would be even slower if we had to make it and then release it on a sort of on-demand basis. It's then released. We talk about the mechanisms of release and brain and behavior through something called a fusion pore. We don't have to worry about that here. Just realize that the neurotransmitter is released by the originating neuron. There is receptor interaction. We'll talk about receptors in a second, but what happens is on the postsynaptic neuron, in our case, a dendrite, there are what are called receptor sites. Now, especially biology students know about receptors, probably for hormones and things like that, works very similar to that. It's like a lock and key mechanism. What happens is a neuron comes along and it opens up, it binds to this receptor site. The thing folds a whole bunch of times. This protein complex, or the sort of receptor complex, folds a whole bunch of times. It goes in and out of the membrane. It's really crazy. And eventually opens what's called an ion channel. And that's the thing that lets, say, sodium in. Typically sodium, except if we're talking about GABA, then it's going to be chlorine. The neurotransmitter molecule is now inactivated. Okay? Now, sometimes, not every neurotransmitter is going to be used. In fact, almost always, more is released than is needed to bind to the binding sites at the next neuron. So it costs a lot of metabolic money to make neurotransmitters. So it would make a great deal of sense to reuse them if you can. So what happens is they get taken back up into the originating neuron. Okay? So if they haven't bound to a binding site at the receptor, then what happens is they're taken back up into the originating neuron. Oops. The only downside of the presentation view is I always have to keep the pointer in the slide. Eventually, they will degrade neurotransmitters. So even if they weren't taken back up, they will, enzymes will come along and break them down. Because you can't have, this is supposed to be a pretty precise system. You don't want extra neurotransmitter just floating around. Right? That's the last thing you want. Now, when you think about this, let's go back. When you think about this, these are all really great places for drug interactions to happen. We could make the neuron make more of the neurotransmitter. How would we do that? Well, we could give people, or they could take of their own free will, not that there's any free will. They could take a drug that is a precursor to the neurotransmitter. For something like Parkinson's disease, which is a problem with dopamine, it's not enough dopamine and not enough dopamine receptors. So you're not making enough dopamine. If that's the case, you might think, well, let's just give them dopamine. But remember, I just told you, it doesn't pass through the blood-brain barrier. You can't just inject it. It doesn't get into the nervous system. What can we do in that case? Well, we give people what's called levodopa or L-DOPA. We give them L-DOPA, which is a precursor to dopamine. The nervous system takes that up and just makes dopamine with it. And it's L, capital L-DOPA. It's not E-L-DOPA. And I say that because it sounds like that, and I once wrote on a test, And I think third year, El Dopa. Like the name of some matador. El Dopa! The prof actually wrote, or the TA probably, because it was big school, wrote on my test, it's not the name of a matador. So it's El-Dopa. Storage, I don't know what we can do about storage as far as drug interaction. Release, we could certainly make release happen. How would we do that? Well, some drugs actually just cause transmitter leakage. Cocaine, methamphetamine, things like that. Transmitters just makes transmitters kind of leak out without action potentials. We could also, by the drug being very similarly shaped to the neurotransmitter, it could bind to the receptor site and cause release. This is how opiate drugs, like things like morphine, it basically is exactly the same shape. It's so similarly shaped to endorphins that it just opens those ion channels. The nervous system basically thinks, and that's a shorthand there, I'm doing air quotes, and I hate people that do air quotes. Never understood it. But what it does is it just opens the ion channel. And we also have receptors for a lot of these drugs. This might surprise you, but a lot of the drugs we take, we have a version of, we roll our own in our brains. We have cannabinoid receptors. We actually make our own THC. Well, it's not THC. It's very similar. We make our own cannabinoids in our brains and all kinds of other places. There are benzodiazepine receptors. In other words, we make our own Valium. So a lot of drugs have receptors, and there are natural things in our brains that are just like those. We just can't get them in the industrial quantities available in a pill, right? Or a bong hit. Well, that's what the kids tell me. The kids say that that's how the drugs are done, with the bongs. One-hitters. When I was young, we used bottle tokers, but that's a whole other... I haven't misspent youth. I was cool once. I was hip with the scene. I was down the street. We can inactivate them. We certainly could have a drug that... I don't know why people have to put chairs everywhere. I walk around and I can't see. This is like, you know, the joke. I can make blind jokes, by the way, because of the blind. It's like the Helen Keller thing. How do you scrub it? You move the furniture, right? This is what they're doing. Somebody... And I blame Ishtvan Imre. It's just putting things in my way. Imre, in my way, almost rhymes. I'm sure he'll make up some bad rap song about it. It'll involve the words clue and me and you. Anyway, guy needs new writers. I can hear some of you humming it now. It's sad, really, that Ishtvan's little song has become an earworm at this university. You know, I could see one day, you know, in 20 years, we'll probably have a football team. It'll take a while. We need more people. We need a football stadium. But that'll be like the marching band. We'll be playing that song. It'll become our school song. Football, it's the clue. Oh, God, he's doing it to me. Oh. The only good thing about it is it's replaced Viva Las Vegas, which has been in my brain all morning, but now it's back. So we could inactivate a neurotransmitter, right? Because those are just enzymes that inactivate. So why not just do the same thing? You take, basically, in essence, take an enzyme. Reuptake. This is how a lot of drugs work. This is how cocaine works. It blocks reuptake of dopamine. Nice. This is how Prozac works. It blocks reuptake of serotonin. It's in a class of drugs called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. That should give you a pretty good idea of how it works. It blocks reuptake. The name tells you the whole thing. Degradation, probably not. So basically, the reason we're talking about synapses, not just because they're cool, is because synapses are where psychoactive drugs work. Right. This is where the action's going to be, is at the synaptic level. Almost always.
There are some drugs that don't quite work there, but they indirectly work there. So you end up with something like caffeine, which is a one that we don't really quite know how it works. Caffeine
blocks the neuromodulator adenosine. Neuromodulators make neurotransmitters work a little bit better, make more efficient. So it actually blocks a neuromodulator. So you could have that as well.
Okay, here's some of the neurotransmitters,
the ones that I think that we're going to care about more or less.
First of all, five conditions have to be met before we call something a neurotransmitter. It has to be present in the terminal.
Okay, in other words, at the end of, of an axon. Whoops, went too far there. No, let's run up. Run up a little more.
It's released on firing.
When the neuron fires, that chemical comes out.
Placing that substance on an organ or on a neuron simulates firing. Now, you say an organ, well, how do you think you move around? I mean, that's
acetylcholine, big-ish stuff,
is flexing your muscles. And then when it's taken up into the next neuron, it's inactivated. Okay.
For the most part, we used to get really upset and excited about these things. Is this a neurotransmitter? Is this not? Especially in the 80s, 80s and 90s even, because a lot of these things were being discovered at that time. When I was an undergrad, we basically were told there were basically five. It's more like about 200. There's 50 for sure, probably, and maybe suspected about 200. Sometimes you'll see in a paper, this suspected neurotransmitter, this putative neurotransmitter. People aren't too concerned about that anymore. Typically, they aren't doing this kind of stuff. It does happen.
That little screen's too small. That's a, make that bigger? No, I can't.
And inactivation blocks stimulation. So if we can inactivate the molecule, say using some sort of enzyme, that and it doesn't make the stimulation work, we're pretty sure then it's not transmitted. It's like some really weird Jeff Foxworthy bit. If you're present in the terminal, you might be a neurotransmitter.
God, he'd be funny if he was funny, eh?
Okay, the neurotransmitters themselves, acetylcholine, oh, they got stuff.
Acetylcholine, we typically think of that one as being something that is
in the peripheral nervous system on the outside, like outside your brain. It makes you move. There are drugs that certainly work here. Typically, they're weapons of mass destruction.
They usually work on something called acetylcholine esterase, which is an enzyme that degrades acetylcholine.
See, if you keep having acetylcholine that it's active sitting inside a neuron, not good. Or sitting, sorry, on your muscles, and it doesn't get broken down. So you keep releasing it, and your muscles keep contracting, 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 and you die. That's how nerve gas works. Well, it's also, by the way, how snake venom works and bee venom. It's a nerve agent. If bees were really big, they'd be bad. We'd be having wars. There'd be a war against bees. It'd be like Starship Troopers.
These are the ones that we're going to care for the most part about, and these are the monoamines. First of all, we've got the catecholamines, norepinephrine, epinephrine, and dopamine. They're almost all the same. If you were to look it up and take a look at what the shape of these molecules were on Wikipedia, and it wasn't the day when SOPA when they decided to block Wikipedia, which I fully support, you would see that these molecules are almost exactly the same. You know, one more carbon. These are always excitatory. There's an indolamine, just one of them, serotonin. And you might look and say, oh, that abbreviation makes sense. That abbreviation makes sense. That 5-HT, 5-hydroxyltryptophan. That's why that's the name of the actual chemical. Everybody calls it serotonin, so we just... A histamine is a neurotransmitter. And I can show you how related these all these monoamines, that the first antipsychotic drugs that were used. Drugs on schizophrenia. So schizophrenia is not multiple personality disorder. The psychology students are all nodding their heads. The biology students are going, really, and writing it down. The ones that haven't taken intro psych. So schizophrenia involves paranoia, right, and delusions and all that stuff, hearing voices, what we call crazy, you know, in popular parlance, right? The first time, and we know now it's a problem with dopamine. We just know that now. It's about a certain kind of dopamine receptor. That's what schizophrenia is, right? That's the cause. It's a biological, well, everything has to at some level be biological. But, I mean, we know it's that simple. The first drugs that were tried were antihistamines. They tried antihistamines on these schizophrenic patients in the late 50s. A guy named Labillie in France. And he ended up having, it had some effect. Some of the symptoms went away. And also, they didn't have stuffy noses anymore. Antihistamines. 2, 3, 4. Anything? Nothing? Okay. So histamine is a neurotransmitter as well. More of them. Here's a few others we'll talk about. There's glutamate and GABA. These are just basically amino acids. GABA is, if for those of you interested, no one ever calls it this. It's gamma amino butyric acid, but it's just called GABA. It's GABA. Okay. Glycine and proline we probably won't ever talk about again. That's proline, not proline. Proline is a sports betting thing. Peptides, substance P. Substance P is the pain neurotransmitter. Why is it called substance P? What a lame-ass name that is, right? Well, for the longest time we figured that there must be a neurotransmitter just for pain signals. There's got to be. So everybody said, it must be there. We're going to give it a name. We'll call it substance P, P for pain. And it got so common in the literature that when it was discovered, people just said, well, keep calling it that. Which is, you know, what they should have done with Vagus stuff, because it's a great name. And finally, morphine-like substances, endorphins and acetylcholines. These were discovered in the early 80s by a woman who's now become a new age nut job, but who at the time was, well, she's obviously quite brilliant, but she was in that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? You ever seen that? What a piece of crap that is. Any movie, by the way, as soon as they show you a brain and they show between neurons, they show electrical bolts instead of it's not how it works, and that should tell you right away they don't know what they're doing. That's a good thing she did, though. Other peptides, these are things we tend to think of as hormones, and of course they act as hormones in the bloodstream. But when they're in the nervous system, they can act as neurotransmitters. So things like insulin, prolactin, human growth hormone, vasopressin. And those are just four that I just picked out of the air. But they can all act as neurotransmitters in the nervous system. So a lot of times it depends. Like, for example, when you look at epinephrine or adrenaline, if it's in the bloodstream, we call it a hormone, because it actually is a hormone. But it also acts in the central nervous system just as a simply as a neurotransmitter. All right. Questions about that? All right. Now, when I talk about these receptors, these transmitters bind to a receptor. It's sort of like it's a lock and key. A lot of you guys know about the lock and key idea of how enzymes work. Same sort of thing here. We have a receptor that has, think of it as the lock, and the transmitter is the key. Okay, so it's just a lock and key mechanism. There's a binding site, that's where the key is, and an ion channel. So if you think of the binding site like a lock, and the ion channel like the door that opens, and the key is the neurotransmitter, you've got a pretty good idea how it works. Okay? So basically, it just one opens the other. Exactly what I'm going to do here. One neuron usually has one kind of receptor, or has a majority of its receptors are for one kind of neurotransmitter. Let's say that. Because, look, you couldn't just have GABA or the thing would never fire, for example, right?
And again, at receptor sites, drug interactions are happening. So you can think of a case where you might have something that opens the, something that's so similar to the neurotransmitter that it opens the ion channel. You might have something that basically, in essence, binds but doesn't open the ion channel. It sort of gums up the works. Naloxone, which I've talked about already a couple of times, works that way. It binds to receptor sites for opiates, but it actually doesn't open the ion channel. Okay? This nervous system can be divided into the central nervous system, which is the brain, the spinal column, and cerebellum. The communication here is all neurons, and it's neurotransmitters. The next system, the next one we're going to care the most about, I'll do something about this, it's getting very annoying, is the peripheral nervous system. These are the nerves that make you move, and the communication here again is neural. Eventually, it's neurotransmitters. Binding to receptors on muscles to make them move. These are pretty hard to repair, central nervous system neurons. There is some repair. These repair. It allows the injury isn't too nasty.
Right.
So, like, if you cut yourself, it's not like you're numb there for the rest of your life. Unless it's a very nasty cut. And then there's the autonomic nervous system. The communication here is all hormonal. And this is the release of things like epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol, things like this. This is the fight or flight response. And the cool down response, which is what the cortisol does. And you'll see sometimes that some of these drugs will affect, we'll talk about CNS effects very typically because we're worried about the sort of cognition and behavior part of it. We'll talk about peripheral effects because a lot of times it's going to be peripheral nervous system effects. When you think about a lot of stimulants, the reason that they're banned substances in athletic competitions is actually they can make you run faster. Right? A little bit of cocaine will make you run faster. A lot of cocaine won't. But a little bit will. It'll actually decrease your reaction time. But so will just taking some, pseudoephedrine. So, you know, Sudafed? Right? Hockey players take Sudafed. NHL hockey players all take this. It's actually kind of a bad thing. And they have to not take it during the Olympics because it's a banned substance, eh? And I've heard hockey players and coaches say, well, you know, we're really likely to get colds because we're near ice, so we have to take a lot of cold medication, and that's not why. That would be a lie. You can take caffeine, but it's a controlled substance, not a banned substance. You can take... The idea is the amount of caffeine you can take before athletic competition is enough that you would have to have had like 38 cups of coffee, right? Or, you know, or 75 Cokes, which you couldn't do because you'd really have to, you have to pee before the 100-meter final. But some things are banned completely, like cocaine is. And the reason it's banned is because it makes you run faster, makes your reaction time better. Just a little bit, not a lot. And of course, there's a guy, what's his name? I forget his name. Canadian horse jumping guy. I don't know what they call that.
Ian Miller?
Ian Miller?
No, it was Ian
no.
Miller.
It was Eric Lamont. Isn't that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Had that problem? His horse was apparently fine, seems to me. I remember I told some of you guys a story before. I remember in 1976, I went to the Olympics in Montreal. And I was watching the guy back in New Zealand won one of the, I don't know the names of the events. I know I couldn't do it. I got a lot of respect for it, but the horse is the athlete. And here's the proof. The guy that won the gold medal was being interviewed, and as he was being interviewed, he lit up a smoke. It just strikes me that, yeah, okay. I'd say a race car driver's more of an athlete. Seriously. Think of the autonomic arousal in race car driving, and the reaction time. I'm serious. Okay. I like Formula One. I don't like the NASCAR where you just go around in circles and try to hit each other. No, it's not good. So you might have a lot of times where, like I said, banned substances. I know some of you guys are interested in this stuff. But sometimes it's just controlled substances. The one that's always bizarre is that marijuana is a banned substance. And you may remember this. You may be, some of you may be a little young for this. But I think it was 2002 when Ross Rebliati had his gold medal taken away. He was given back, by the way. It was taken away because he tested positive for THC. Really, a snowboarder? What a surprise. And I remember thinking, you know, marijuana, what it's going to do when you're at the top of a hill on a snowboard at a, you know, an Olympic event, you're going to go, dude, I'm not doing that. Maybe I'll slide down sitting on it. That'd be kind of awesome. I'm really hungry right now. I don't think it's a performance enhancer. And I loved his excuse. He should have just said, I'm a snowboarder. We're all high. But no, what did he say? I was at a party. Some guys were smoking weed. It must have been from that, you know, secondhand weed smoke. So, I mean, no. He should have just said, I got high sometime. It's none of your business. International Olympic Committee. All right. Questions about the brain stuff?
Is it neural communication with the ANS, too? Or is it like
No, the ANS, no, it's all hormonal. So simply neural. So that's why it's slower, right? When you think about the peripheral nervous system, it seems like it isn't true, but it seems like this is happening instantaneously. I'm just deciding to do, I don't know, I'm going to stop this now. But it seems like I'm doing it instantaneously. If the fight or flight response kicks in, that can take a minute, right? A lot of times, if you've ever been in a situation where you've had a close call of some sort. Let's say like a car accident that, you know, you avoided it. You turned the wheel quickly, everything was fine. You know, you're on, this happened to us, we're on Highway 69. And, you know, an 18-wheeler almost was coming right at us, almost hit us. Isabel is a great driver. I feel safe in the world, only with two people left in the world. And because with my dad would have been three, with my daughter driving and my wife. Anybody else, I'm like this. So, Isabel's great. She avoided the truck. We're driving along, and I looked at her and I said, you're going to start feeling really freaked out really shortly. You should know it's really normal. It's going to take about a minute for all the adrenaline to pump into your blood, and your mouth's going to get dry, and your heart's going to beat. Everything's going to get really bright because your pupils are going to dilate. Don't worry, it's normal. And I said, maybe we should pull off just for about a minute just to cool down. She's like, oh, I'll be fine. Oh, you're right. So it takes a little longer because it's all hormonal, and you've got to, the pineal gland has to tell, well, the hypothalamus has to tell the pineal gland has to tell other gland, release the hormones! Right? So it takes quite a bit longer than the almost instantaneous reactions that we seem to, they aren't instantaneous, but that we seem to have when we're using our peripheral nervous system rather than our autonomic. Yep. I mean, or if you've ever been even in a fight or something. But not a fight, like it gets to a point where and then you just back off, and then you suddenly your mouth's all dry, you're actually ready for fighting or running away. Bravely running away, and that's what you should do usually. He bravely ran away. Brave Sir Robin, yeah. Holy Grail, anybody? No, what's wrong with you people? Okay, good, so some of you are humming it, that's good. Remember during the first Gulf War, they were interviewing, back in the 90s there, they were interviewing a Royal Air Force crew after going on a bomb. And of course, nobody had been to war then. We didn't used to fight wars because there was, we were scared of the Russians, they were scared of us. It's the first time these guys had ever really been in combat, and they'd flown this mission in Iraq, and they dropped some bombs. They interviewed these guys, Royal Air Force guys, and they were too nice. Well, BBC guys, too. Well, what was it like flying your first combat mission over Iraq? Because that's how BBC reporters talk, right? And the RAF... The pilot was like, well, it wasn't so bad, you know, you come in low and fast, you drop your bombs, and you bravely run away. it's an excellent, you know, unique reference right there. The best Monty Python reference, though, I ever saw, John Cleese was on Letterman in like 1983, just after the Falkland Islands War, which many of you don't know about, read about it on Wikipedia, not today, because it's blacked out. And when the Argentinians sunk the HMS Sheffield, it was a destroyer, and it was going down, and they knew it was going to sink. And John Cleese said, and I saw the sailors on the deck of the HMS Sheffield as it was burning, singing, always look on the bright side of life. And it was like, that's awesome. It's the greatest thing ever. Well, warp thing isn't great, but Okay, enough Monty Python references. Let's talk about dependence and addiction. I don't know why there are exclamation points there. I guess I was, it was a lot of cocaine that day. I don't know why I was so excited. But apparently I was. This thing's really pissing me off. All right. People thought about it. In fact, until very recently, drug addiction, drug-taking behavior seemed to be very strange behavior. And even think about it today, it's strange behavior. You're typically not avoiding pain. You know, like if you're drinking alcohol, it's not you're not treating a symptom. Like if you're with your friends and you decide you're gonna go up for a night of cocktails, have some of them Manhattans, a lovely Manhattan. You're not really doing it to avoid anything, to treat a symptom. You're just going out drinking. Now, some people can just go out drinking now and then. Some people drink till they vomit. Every time. Those people are called losers, by the way, but that's the technical medical term. But there are people that overdo it whenever they start, right? Doesn't matter what they're taking. And other people can have 5 or 6 drinks and be all happy and crazy, but they're not getting ridiculous. But some people, it goes the other way. And you don't actually need this. It's not like food or air or water. It's not like you can live without. I mean, I know we've all said, boy, do I ever need a drink right now. Or many of us have. Some of you are thinking it right now. Or, you know, if you smoke, oh, God, you really need to smoke. Right? Or whatever. I could really use some acid right now. I mean, I'm sure those people would say that. I've never heard that one. But you don't really need it, either. Right? You can live without it. So it's odd behavior. Well, here's the solution. You're probably an immoral pig with very little willpower. That's what you are. You're a junkie lowlife. As many of the comments often say on YouTube, you should just kill yourself. I want to meet one of these people. Remember that? You seen that SNL sketch when they're talking to the people that put comments on YouTube? It's one of the greatest things ever. That's what people thought. You have a lack of moral fiber, right? You're a bad person. And in fact, a lot of people still think that, right? Think about it. Oh, I'd never become a junkie. I'm better than that. Yeah. So. Okay. Maybe, though, it's not a problem with your character or morality. Let's say it's pretty clear it isn't. But if it's not a problem with your character or morality, what is it? You must be sick. You have a disease. Or today, of course, we would call it disorder. Because disease apparently is a bad word. No one says, you know, do you have, I don't know, I got the flu. Oh yeah, it's quite a disorder. You know. I'm differently abled. I don't make insulin. That's not what people with diabetes say. They say, I have diabetes. Oh, but you have special abilities. Like I could die if I ate a chocolate bar. So it's a disease. You've heard this many times. You will hear politicians say this all the time of different political stripes for different reasons. You'll usually hear sort of left of center people talking about how it should be treated like a disease and it's all about treatment. You'll hear right of center people using the same kind of language but talking about also, you know, perhaps locking them up so nobody else catches it. That part was a bit of an editorial. This started with the idea of alcoholism. I never trust words with ism at the end, by the way. I just find them. That's just a personal thing with me. I don't like isms much. Now, look, people have been having drinking problems since people have been drinking, which is really since the beginning of people hanging out in towns. So, if people have had these problems for a long time, maybe there are people, and sometimes it'd be really bad. When you look at
during Prohibition, things like that, and people started making their own gin. Making your own beer is one thing. Making your own gin, you can kill yourself doing that. So you end up with people that are having a real problem, and when Alcoholics Anonymous started up, they started thinking of this not as anything about your character. They said, look, these people are sick. Okay. I would like to ask people who think it's a disease, what's the disease mechanism? How does that work? Now, do we know how every disease works?
Nope.
But we know how a lot of them work. And this idea has been around for 100 years, and people have thrown hundreds and millions of dollars at alcohol research, drug-taking research in general, and no one's figured out the mechanism of the disease. We know how AIDS works. We can't stop it yet, but we know how it works. That took like 3 years. So, in all that time, no one knows what the disease mechanism is. So that's something, a strike, it seems to me, against a disease model. It doesn't make it not true. It just seems to me that we would know something by now. People will retort with that, it's genetic, though. And this is true. Alcoholism runs in families. If you are an alcoholic and you have a twin brother, he or she is much more likely, he or she, well, transgendered, I guess that could happen, is much more likely to be an alcoholic as well, rather than if you have your dizygotic twins, you know, fraternal twins. There's a big genetic component here. There's also a big genetic component in your eye color. We don't call that a disease. It's a set of behaviors, and it's a problem. I'm not discounting that. You got to understand that if I say it's not a disease, and I think the disease model is stupid, and so does Bill McKim in the book. I think it's silly because of these reasons, but I'm not saying it's not a problem. It's a serious thing, and I know many of you guys, just because chances are, know people with alcohol problems. There are probably people in this room with alcohol problems. Some of your parents, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, usually it's an uncle. It seems that way. Your creepy old drunk uncle. Right? Most of us have one of them. I don't. I've got... My uncle's not like that. I got a whole bunch of other stories of my uncle, but I'll leave those to when I'm not recording. He's not a bad guy. Hi, Drew. Like he's listening. He's like some kind of executive with Domtar or something. He's out making paper. Or as I usually say to him, you're out destroying the planet, right, Drew? That's in fun. It's all in fun. I like Drew. I really do. My uncle. I'm his brother. Anyway, that's about my Uncle Drew. You will learn so much about me that you don't want to know. And that's... So I know many of you have been touched by alcohol problems. But it doesn't mean it's a disease. Right? We don't call... If we've got somebody that we know that's like an asshole, we don't call that a disease, do we? We say that's a set of behaviors we don't like, and it can even be debilitating for that person. Maybe they can't make friends because no one likes them because they're such a dick. Right? No, really, seriously, think about that. But do we call that a disease? Well, if it goes too far, we call it a personality disorder. That's true. Right? So I'm not sure about the disease model. So like my response to the genetic thing is I don't really, that's not evidence of it being a disease or not. Okay, so I'm not fond of the disease model, and you'll note in the book, neither is Bill McKim. The physical dependence model, around the same time, a little bit before, morphine became a real problem in the world in the late 1800s. Like a real, you see all the war on drugs now? Ha! You know, the consumption of morphine in the United States after the American Civil War was like 13 pounds per 1,000 person per year. That's a lot more than ever with the heroin and such. People don't really realize we live in a pretty good time. People, if
physicians looked at this and said, well, what the hell's going on? Why are people devoting their lives to morphine?
Here's an idea. Morphine will cause what's called the creation of autotoxin. It'll make your body make poison. Autotoxin.
That's the withdrawal symptoms would be caused by this autotoxin.
This isn't true, okay?
But people thought. And that's actually, you don't know much about physiology.
Don't know much about physiology. Don't know much neuropharmacology.
When you're looking at, you might think, that's actually quite sensible, isn't it? It's wrong, but it's a sensible hypothesis. So, then it turned out that no one could find autotoxin, because there isn't any. But the idea of it being something that you physically need really stuck. You will hear people say this all the time.
Oh, I'm not physically addicted to cigarettes. It's just psychological. That's another one of my dumb guy voices. That's a clue that that's stupid.
It's still a very popular idea.
And you might think, yeah, the neat thing, withdrawal from morphine is unpleasant. Yeah, and after 36 hours, the withdrawal symptoms are gone.
But morphine costs our country, a lot of Western countries, a great deal of money to treat people. And they should be treated, you know, no doubt. This is a very popular notion.
This actually, the nice thing about this is it accounts for all the abnormality of it. So does the disease model. If we threw this together with the disease model,
which is what most people do to this day,
MDs especially, big into this,
this accounts for all the abnormality of drug-taking behavior. And I mean, you know, drug problem drug-taking behavior, not like now and then having some. I mean like turning your life into a cesspool of heroin and vomit. That was a nice image, really, for this in the morning, wasn't it? That'll be the title of today's lecture, Cesspool of Heroin and Vomit. So you combine that with the disease model, and you got yourself a whole thing. I can't believe it. Some of the stuff that comes out of my mouth, you know, you know the little man that lives in your head that's supposed to censor things out? My guy quit like 10 years ago. He's on stress leave. He's a George Costanza alum, by the way.
Now, does this only work with depressants? The original idea was depressants, like alcohol and morphine, create autotoxin, which makes you sick. And the only way to stop autotoxin is take more morphine. Now, but then why do people take cocaine and devote their lives to cocaine? And again, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, cocaine was not a very popular drug. The Pope took cocaine. And I mean openly. It wasn't like he was quietly going, go over there and pray. No, the Pope took cocaine. Sigmund Freud took cocaine. The Tsar of all the Russias took cocaine. Pretty cool. They were pretty hip, weren't they? Henrik Ibsen took cocaine. You ever read an Ibsen play? Very depressing. I think it was when he was coming down he typically did his writing. So, people said, well, people take cocaine to excess. So, and this the reason this is an old idea, an old reference, is that this was when people were saying, well, that can't produce autotoxin, it's not a depressant. And then Tatum and Seaver said, well, it becomes a habit, just a habit. Problem is, stimulants actually don't produce, in the small amounts people can take, don't produce withdrawal symptoms that are on a par with depressants. Did they produce withdrawal symptoms? Yes, of course. But nothing like what's happening with depressants. Not even close. You don't really get a cocaine hangover. You sleep for a long time. There's other things too, and I'm not saying that, you know, oh good, take cocaine.
No withdrawal symptoms. Fun. You know, it's not. I'm not giving you advice. You want to take? Go ahead. Just don't drive a car. Do whatever the hell you want. As long as you're not paying. You know, don't go to school on cocaine. Don't take care of little kids on cocaine. Anything else, I don't give. Go nuts. I really don't care. Well, so now this was very upsetting. Because you can see it's a problem. I think we should invent a new idea. It's psychological dependence. First of all, this splits up mind and body, which makes me angry. But, you know, I'm a psychologist. People splitting up mind and body makes me angry. Just one of those things that happens. The average person does think your mind and body are separate things. Average person's average because they don't know that. This is when you need a drug, but you don't need it physically. Right? So it's when you need a drug, but you don't need a drug. It's when you just crave a drug. But you don't need it physically. Right? So when do you crave a drug? When you're psychologically dependent. When are you psychologically dependent? When you crave a drug. Well, wait a second. Go back a second. Are you saying that I crave drugs because I'm psychologically dependent? Yes, I am. How do you know I'm psychologically dependent? Well, because you crave drugs. Why, you're brilliant. Could I subscribe to your newsletter? You have a blog of some sort I can look at? It's a ridiculous notion, because it's completely circular. Right? Another popular one, though. People try to... Addiction counselors will tell people about physical and psychological dependence. Sad, really. Problems here. People abuse drugs that do not produce withdrawal. They can actually will take drugs without... And to a point where it's a problem. And I can define a drug problem very loosely as when you take drugs and it affects your life negatively. So it strikes me that if you drink a lot every night and it's actually not affecting your life, like, say, me... I don't drink a lot every night. I have a few beers every night, sure. I'm a grown-up. I can do that now. When I first moved away, first thing I bought a case of beer and a whole thing of Oreos, and I just started eating. I called my mom. I said, "You know what I'm doing right now, Mom? I'm eating Oreos and drinking beer." She said, "Well, why are you telling me? I don't care." You know, and it felt so good. But there are people that will take drugs to excess that affect their life. And I think let's call that a drug problem. I don't like using the word addiction, but that is what we would probably call it. But you can do it to a point where you don't actually get withdrawal symptoms. And withdrawal is simply dependence is simply the existence of withdrawal symptoms. That's how it's defined. Okay? It's nothing psychological or anything like that. We can just operationally define it. Say we have withdrawal symptoms, we have dependence. So if you got up this morning and you had a headache until you drank coffee, you are caffeine dependent. Don't let it bother you. It's pretty safe. So what we have here is addiction without dependence. Drugs that don't produce withdrawal even. We all know a guy. Right? Like a real pothead. People that just are high all the time. And I'm not saying, like, I know a guy that gets high all the time, but he's a rather successful neuroscientist. So it doesn't seem to affect him. I'm not going to tell you his name. But that's him. He writes straight and edits high. He said if he can understand these complicated neuroscience ideas when he's stoned, he must have written them very clearly. He's published more articles than I have. So give him credit. That's not a drug problem. On the other hand, you know the guy. Remember the guy in high school that always smelled like weed? You know? Maybe even like grade 7, grade 8, he smelled like weed. Yeah. If it was the 70s and it wasn't for most of you guys, any of you probably, he wore a stoner jacket. Yeah, he looked like Jimbo on the Simpsons typically. He did. That's what he looked like. Like to listen to Foghat. You know, it's a whole other subculture. Those people have a drug problem. There are really no withdrawal symptoms from smoking weed. There really aren't any. There are effects from taking it. You get hungry, the munchies, you get the
get the dries, right? You get thirsty. This is what people tell me. But no, it's not really withdrawal symptoms. Nothing nasty. You might feel a little slow, a little sluggish. Take a couple of bong hits, you'll be fine. But that's a drug problem. That's a drug problem. So you got addiction without dependence even. That wrecks the whole thing. There must be a better way. Well, of course there is, or we just quit and say, class, course dismissed. Y'all get 3 credits. People used to think you couldn't get animals addicted. In other words, have a drug problem. There's a couple reasons why they aren't moral, so we can't say they're immoral. Well, that was thrown out. But they couldn't get the disease. Because autotoxin apparently was only made, this is one of the ideas of the autotoxin hypothesis, it's only made by humans. Sometimes people sort of marry a hypothesis and then they end up having to make everything fit their hypothesis. Well, what people did is they used a catheter or a cannula right into the brain. And they found, Thompson and Schuster found that rats could work for drugs. They'll push a bar for drugs. And this was both for morphine and for amphetamine. They'll actually do that at the expense of pushing the other bar that gives them food. That's what I call a drug problem. The nice thing is we can give them so little that we don't get any withdrawal symptoms. Just a little hit, a little zzz. Even better, you know what you can do? Electrical stimulation of the brain and a certain part, which we'll talk about on the next slide. You can get a rat to do anything for just a little bit of electricity to its nucleus accumbens. You can probably get them to talk and stuff. You get them to write your essay. And that doesn't produce any withdrawal symptoms at all. We're actually just directly operating the reward circuit. So this actually seems circular, because what I'm saying is that people take drugs because they feel good. And so feeling good is the reinforcer. Now a reinforcer, if we use the operational definition that Skinner used back in the 30s kind of thing, a reinforcer is any behavior, sorry, any event that increases the likelihood of behavior. That's technically what a reinforcer is. The problem is it's circular, because then I can ask you what increases behavior, and you say a reinforcer, what's a reinforcer, anything that increases behavior, and it's the same problem with the psychological model, right? The difference is we actually have a physiological explanation for this. We know where the feel-good circuit is in your brain. We know where that is. And it runs on dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter we just talked about a little while ago. And it goes from the ventral tegmental area, the VTA, to the medial forebrain bundle, to the nucleus accumbens, A-C-C-U-M-B-E-N-S. The rest of those words you should not spell, but accumbens is an odd word. So ventral tegmental area, medial forebrain bundle, nucleus accumbens. This is in your limbic system. So it's in an older part of your brain, evolutionarily older. This area is activated when you do well on a test. Get your mark back, you look and go, oh yeah, feels good. This area is activated when you eat food you like. This area is activated when you have an orgasm. This area is activated when you take heroin. Smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol. Almost every drug we talk about, except hallucinogens, like acid, LSD, it doesn't actually operate that system. It doesn't directly. Some people find perceptual anomalies really interesting and fun, which then operates their reward circuit. So if we know where the reward circuit is, and you're going to find this throughout this course, whenever we talk, and next time we likely will start talking about alcohol because we'll be through this stuff. And almost every single drug we talk about that people take for fun
operates one or all of these, has receptors in one or all of these brain regions. On the other hand, there is one set of drugs that we'll talk about that no one likes to take. And they're antipsychotic drugs. And you know what they do? They block dopamine. Oh, look, that runs on dopamine. So it fits in quite nicely. Okay, if I give you morphine to the paraaqueductal ventral gray area, it's basically it's part of where the pain receptors are. Okay, the PVG. That actually leads to dependence. That'll lead to the withdrawal symptoms. If I give you morphine right to your nucleus accumbens, it doesn't. So it's typically not activating this that's causing the dependence. The fact is that most drugs, pretty much everything we'll talk about, is not something that's just designed just to operate this. It also affects other parts of the brain, and that's where the dependence comes from. Okay? If I take an electrode, a microelectrode, and put it across the nucleus accumbens in a rat, I can... If you know what you're doing, you can train a rat to do a lot of things. And all you do is you give it food, you give it a reinforcer, after it does something you like. So let's say you're doing an experiment where you are training a rat on a maze, which, I mean, I've done tons of those. Typically what you do is you leave little pieces of food closer and closer and closer to where you want the rat to go down the end of the arm edge. When the rat learns, I'm supposed to run down these arms. And there's food at the end. That might take you a while. I've seen people take, to get rats to say even something as simple as on a big board, to go to one corner of that board and stand there, or you can give them food. That can take 2 or 3 hours. What rats tend to do is they walk around the edges, and they just keep walking around. Getting them to stop and stand right there and maybe rear up like this, that takes a long time. I've seen people do that with 90 seconds. 90 seconds with brain stimulation to the accumbens. So you just hook up an electrode. Every time he gets close, you get a little zap. If we could do this, if we could drill holes in our heads and directly operate the accumbens, the economy would collapse, because we'd all just be sitting around going, oh, yeah. Pushing the button. So Schuster, which we talked about before, found that rats will work for drugs not causing withdrawal, so that means no dependence. But they will work for drugs, especially if they're injected right to the nucleus accumbens. So we have no dependence now. It's got nothing to do with being... with withdrawal symptoms whatsoever. It's because it feels good. One of the hard things to do with rats is to get them to take things orally. We can inject right into their brain, and that's easy. Because we just hook them up that way. You put them under, you take off the top of their skull, you put a cannula in, and you put the skull back on. Well, you put a plastic skull back on. Why does that bother you so much?
They have two sitting at home.
What? Cannula?
Rats. Rats. Yeah. Two pet rats.
Well, don't do it to them.
I don't plan on it.
Yeah.
Look, these rats get a pretty good life. They're fed well, all that stuff. They also get sweet, sweet drugs for a few months. You know, so they're okay. And they don't get withdrawal symptoms. It's hard to get them to take stuff orally. You can, but it's hard to do. So that's something you got to keep in mind. We can always look at this stuff, comparing it to humans, but we tend to take, there are some drugs, alcohol, we take orally. It's hard to get rats to smoke little cigarettes. Right? Remember Bart doing that with the dog in that one episode? That was his experiment. The smoking caused lung cancer in Santa's Little Helper. And the dog's walking around with a butt hanging out of its mouth and coughing. Are you going to take alcohol? The first person that got rats to voluntarily take alcohol was a former Algoma University student who did her degree a few years ago. She's now a prof in Edmonton.
and Lynn Honey is her name, and I'll talk about her work later on in the course. Now and then you will see her making snide comments on my Facebook wall. I taught her everything she knows. No, not about the drug stuff. That was great. Great work. And Lynn actually got rats to drink alcohol voluntarily, and they'd have little rat cocktail parties, basically, before they were fed, which is kind of cool. Very sort of Mad Men, like Mad Men rats, right? Da-da. Oh, I can't wait for that show to come back. What years are going to be now in that show? Like 1979? I mean, they've had enough of a lag now. So one of the things that Pickens and Thompson found was that actually drug use follows the laws of learning. Now, I'm not going to go into what the laws of learning are, because you could have a whole course in that. It's called Psychology/Biology 3306. So we're not going to go into that. But I can tell you that when we think of drug use as a behavior and the fun part of it as a reinforcer, it works perfectly. It explains the behavior. We can make predictions that you can't make with the physiological dependence model, the psychological dependence model, the disease model, or the your immoral model, which isn't really a model. So I'm saying it's just conditioning. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Why do people take heroin? Because it feels really, really, really good. I've never taken heroin. I've seen people take heroin. And that very first part, after they inject themselves, they are having a hell of a good time. I had a friend of mine who used to take heroin say that it's like your whole body is having an orgasm for about 40 minutes. Sounds like we should all go get some right now, doesn't it? Right? I mean, it sounds pretty fun. See, it explains this, a lot of the stuff that we're not, that is sort of anomalous about drug taking behavior. Excuse me. It explains the paradox of the positive and negative effects of drugs. One of the important things about learning is the last behavior right after the most recent behavior to the that happens before the reinforcer is what's reinforced. Okay? So you drink, it feels really good. How many times have you woken up in the morning after drinking and said to yourself, I'm never drinking again? It's happened to many of us. I can see the smirks on many faces. And I'm like blind. And then someone calls you and says, you know, so you're finally over your hangover. You might have had some greasy food, which is the good hangover cure. It really isn't, but it always feels like it is. Or a super big gulp of 7-Eleven of Coke and the Globe and Mail and a pack of cigarettes. That used to be my hangover cure when I was in graduate school. I'm amazed I'm still alive. I really am. 2 liters of Coke and smokes. I'll be fine. Like 4 liters of Coke and a whole bag of Cheetos a day. I really can't believe I'm alive. But then you go drinking again because you think, oh, well, what the hell, it'll be fun. Because the effect, the pleasure, happens right after ingesting the alcohol. The puking happens later. A lot of drugs have negative side effects. They're not fun. Heroin, you know. Not good. Withdrawal from heroin, no fun. Withdrawal from alcohol, even worse. Like, I mean real withdrawal from alcohol. You know, like alcoholics, professional drinkers. Actually, hallucinating and having the DTs, feeling stuff crawling up you, that kind of stuff. That's, I would imagine, exceedingly unpleasant. But they still drink. So it explains that. A choice in taking a drug depends on other available reinforcers. In fact, it follows something called the matching law. And I'm not going to go greatly into this, just to say that animals, including humans, will distribute their behavior based on the reinforcement ability of various reinforcers. So if I give you two pieces of food versus one, and you're a rat, you're going to need twice as many responses to get two pieces of food as you do for the one. You'll distribute your behavior like that. And we seem to do that with drugs.
So if there's no available reinforcers, there's always one in the bottle. So if you have no life and no prospects, and you hear people all the time talk about this, people that don't know anything about poor people, say all they do is spend all their money on cigarettes and beer. Well, you know, maybe that's the only fun they have. Do you ever think of that? This explains why, at a societal level, lower socioeconomic status, more drug problems, just in general. Why? Well, you know what? I may not be paid $1 billion a year, but I make a decent salary. I got a family. I got all that great stuff. I got an Xbox. Two of them. I got a PS3. I got all kinds of crap. I got all kinds of things I can get reinforcement out of. I'm not as likely, because of the socioeconomic status I live in, to have a drug problem as someone that has nothing. I can get pleasure, literally, honestly, out of teaching you guys. I'm as hard to believe as it may seem. Right? Even a little sort of snort of a sympathy laugh is enough for me. Thank you. That, my accumbens just was firing, right? I get reinforcement out of that. I get reinforcement out of tonight, go with my daughter. We're going to a thing. Long story. Board dinner or something, I don't know. All this kind of stuff. I get reinforcement out of that. So I don't take my whole paycheck when I get it and buy heroin. But if I had nothing, I know where I can get reinforcement. There's a guy in the corner who sells crack cocaine. So it explains it at that level, and also at the level of a rat pressing a bar. I love this model. All right. Questions? All right, pack it in for here. We'll have pack it in here rather for now. We'll take a look at... I think we'll start talking about alcoholics. Thanks, guys.
Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. Really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I don't wanna nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I'd like to help you, Tom, in any way I can. I sure appreciate it. back to my colleagues who were chewing on the doors. I guess we'll table this for now. I'm glad to see you take constructive criticism well. Thank you for your time. I know we're all busy as hell. And we'll put this thing to bed when I bash your head open.
All we want to do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the doors. We'll all come inside and eat your brains.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.